mindfulness, cultivate our motivation. So for a long time we've been wandering in samsara, in all different realms of rebirth, in all different sorts of bodies, plus so many different kinds of samsaric experiences, and very often being born in unfortunate rebirths with a lot of suffering. And so this lifetime having a fortunate rebirth, and particularly in our mind having attraction to the Dharma, having interest in the Dharma, having regard for spirituality, something within us that's quite precious, and we haven't always had it. So let's appreciate our interest in the Dharma, our interest in living an ethical life, our attraction towards monasticism, and appreciating and respecting that quality within ourselves. Let's try to enhance it and build upon it and expand it, so that we can develop the three higher trainings of ethical conduct, concentration, and wisdom, and then with the bodhicitta attain supreme enlightenment. So let that be our long-term motivation, as well as our motivation for being together this afternoon.
It doesn't
apply to money and possessions and things like that. Yeah, sorrow and sickness only is applying to sentient beings. Okay. So, yesterday we heard the beginning of the Noble Path and how the Buddha realized that he was subject to birth, aging, sickness, death, sorrow, and defilement, and was seeking that which is also subject to those. And then the thought dawned on him, suppose I sought what was not subject to birth, aging, sickness, death, sorrow, and defilement, and instead sought the supreme security of nirvana. So he had that thought, he changed the focus of his life. So before, you know, having material possessions, family, that whole thing was what his life was all about, what he thought was the path of happiness. Now he's steering, going in another direction, seeking nirvana. Okay? Now it's not just sufficient to turn our mind away from samsara and seek nirvana. It's not just sufficient, because as we'll see in the Buddha's own tale, he was seeking nirvana, but he had some difficulty finding a teacher who would lead him there. Okay? So, but I don't want to tell you too much of the story. So let's come back to what the Buddha said here. So he said, later, while still young, a black-haired young man, endowed with the blessings of youth, in the prime of life, though my mother and father wished otherwise and wept with tearful faces, I shaved off my hair and beard, put on the yellow robe, and went forth from the home life into homelessness. So there he was, the prime of his life, where everybody in society looks and says, you've got a great future in front of you, my boy. go into plastics and that has a special meaning for my generation. What does it mean? Who wants to explain it?
Go into high tech.
Yeah. There was a movie called
The Graduate.
Okay, about the young man who just... We should get it and watch it together, actually. This is a pivotal movie in my... Because he really expressed how we felt. Yeah, he had just graduated from college, and everybody says, you have a bright future, you're going to go and get the American dream and do everything society wants you to do. And he saw it as totally meaningless. And at one party, maybe it was his graduation party, I can't remember, all of his parents' friends were clouding around him. And what are you going to do now, young man, with your bright future? And of course he had no idea, and he had no interest in doing anything. So he just made it up, and he said, I'm going into plastics. Yeah.
They were all happy.
Yeah, they were all very happy. Oh, you'll be so successful. Yeah. Okay. Well, we should see. We should watch that.
Yes. I don't think it's appropriate.
Track of romantic love.
Yes.
That was the final highest thing in that movie.
Right.
So that's the other.
Yes. Yeah, that was the piece of our generation. Reject the material things, but romantic love was it. You know. Okay. So, it's like here you are, and your parents, your family, all of society has so much expectation. They've spent their whole lives nurturing you, teaching you, helping you to evolve because they love you so much and they want you to have everything they didn't have, And everything they weren't able to do, they want you to be able to do. Everything they weren't able to be, they want you to be able to be. Okay? So they're looking at you as the fulfillment of their own unfulfilled wishes and dreams. And then he said, I'm shaving my hair and beard and I'm going off to be a monastic. Yeah. And so, freak out. Okay. It is very interesting, when you get ordained when you're young, the reactions of other people. Yeah. Sometimes they say, oh, you're so attractive, really. It's a pity that you don't get married. Yeah, what a waste. all these kinds of things. And if your mind isn't strong and you have a lot of the societal conditioning behind you, it becomes quite difficult. Yeah? So you have to be very clear and very firm about what you're doing and why. Okay, but he put on the yellow robe. It was yellow because at the time of the Buddha, the saffron or yellow color was considered unattractive, and so that was the color that all the mendicants wore. Yeah, and so you'll still see that in India today, the different wandering mendicants, they'll wear kind of an orange saffron kind of color. It's considered very unattractive. Of course, when Buddhism went to China, that was the color that the emperor wore, so monastics weren't allowed to wear it. And instead, gray and black were considered unattractive. So the Chinese robes became gray and black. Kind of like Catholic, gray and black is, They don't have the colorful 99 gray on. Okay. And so with his mother and father tearful, he shaved his hair and his beard because, for a young man, it's very interesting to watch young men. They all want to grow their beard out just to see if they can. You watch. They get to a certain age, they all have a beard, and then pretty soon they get tired and they shave it off. But in India, the men very often had beards and they had long hair. And so you'll see in the story of the Buddha's life, this scene, because he left the palace in the middle of the night. You know, his son was just born, and his wife was sleeping. He snuck out and had his charioteer drop him off in the middle of nowhere and change clothes with him. And there's a scene where he has his sword, and he's holding up his long hair, and he's cutting it off. Okay? And so that this is something atypical in India, you know, for people to have no hair and no beard. And so actually monastics are not supposed to have beards and hair and stuff like that. Okay. Having gone forth, monastics, in search of what is wholesome, seeking the supreme state of sublime peace, I went to Alara Kamala and said to him, Alara Kamala was one of the great teachers at the time of the Buddha. There were several great teachers at that time, and they all had different sects and, you know, with their own disciples. Okay. Actually, the term Shravaka, which is translated as hearer, and we talk about the hearer's vehicle, actually, at the time of the Buddha, Shravaka just meant disciple. And so all these different teachers, these non-Buddhist teachers, had their own shravakas, or people who heard and listened to their teachings, who were their disciples.
Were the Hindus mostly then?
Hinduism didn't exist at this time. This was, the Vedas were very strong. So you had the Brahmas and the recluses, or the, sometimes instead of recluses, they were called wanderers or ascetics. So the Brahmins had the Vedic lineage that was passed down in the family, and the Brahmins prided themselves on having a superior rebirth from Brahma's mouth or something like that. They were the upper caste. They had control of spirituality. If you wanted to make offering to the gods, you had to go to the Brahmas and ask them to do a ritual, because not everybody was qualified to do rituals. Okay, so there were the Brahmins, who were entrenched in society and were the high caste, and then you had the wanderers or recluses or ascetics who had renounced all of that, and they followed their own individual teachers, and they were all seeking nirvana, but they had their own paths, you know, according to each teacher of, you know, what is the path to attain nirvana. Okay? And so at this point, you know, the Buddha knows he doesn't want the family life. He's going forth into the homeless life. But now he needs a teacher. And so he goes to Alara Kamala, who was one of the great teachers at his time. Yeah, who was the leader of one of these groups of wanderers. Okay? And said, friend Kalama, I want to lead the holy life in this Dhamma and discipline. Alara Kalama replied, the Venerable One may stay here. This Dharma is such that a wise person can soon enter upon and abide in it, realizing for himself through direct knowledge his own teacher's doctrine. So he's saying, I have a path. It's not a difficult path. Any wise person can enter it, and then before too long, know with direct experience the result and gain the fruit of that teacher's doctrine. So the Buddha said, I soon quickly learned that Dharma. As far as mere lip reciting and rehearsal of his teaching went, I could speak with knowledge and assurance, and I claimed I know and see, and there were others who did likewise. So he knew by the mouth the doctrine. Yeah, and so he claimed that he had attained it, and there were others who did as well. I considered, it is not through mere faith alone that Alara Kalama declares, by realizing for myself with direct knowledge, I enter upon and abide in this Dharma. Certainly Alara Kalama abides knowing and seeing this Dharma. Then I went to Alara Kalama and asked him, friend Kalama, in what way do you declare that by realizing for yourself with direct knowledge you enter upon and abide in this Dharma? In reply, he declared the base of nothingness. So the Buddha figured Alara Kamala. He wasn't just mouthing some doctrine. He didn't just have blind faith. He actually had some realization. So he went to him and said, "What realization do you have?" And Alara Kamala said, "The base of nothingness." Okay. Now what this means is in these stages of developing concentration or samadhi. Well, let's start with this. You know, in our first opening prayers, we talk about the three worlds, the Buddhist master, the three worlds. So the three worlds is the desire realm, the form realm, and the formless realm. So the beings in the desire realm are filled with sensual desire. The beings in the form realms have actualized certain states of samadhi. There's four form realm absorptions or states of samadhi. Those form realms are also in Pali called the jhanas, or in Sanskrit, dhyana. Okay? And how do you say dhyana? In Japanese, zen. How do you say it in Chinese? Chan. Okay, so the Zen and the Chan traditions are named after this practice of meditation, particularly attaining these four states of jhana. So in the form realm, you can be an ordinary being in the desire realm, like one of us, but after you attain jhine, or shamatha, or serenity, okay, after you attain that, then the next step is to enter into the first jhana, okay, the first dhyana. Yeah? And so at that point, your body is in the desire realm, because you're a human being, but your mind, for the time that you're in meditation, becomes a form realm mind, because you have that realization of the form realm, the first jhana. Okay? And so you can continue up to the second, third, and fourth there. If you, while meditating like this, if you don't develop wisdom and so on, you are accumulating what is called immutable karma, or another translation is unwavering karma. When you study the 12 links, they talk about two kinds of virtuous karma. One is ordinary and one is this immutable. So what this means is that you are a human being, but by developing this level of samadhi, you are creating the karma to be born in that corresponding level of jhana in your next life. Yeah? Okay? So when, if you die and you die with that samadhi, then you get born according to whichever level, 1 through 4, that you've attained while a human being. You get born in that God realm, in that form realm, where the beings have a subtle kind of form, and they spend a lot of time, you know, in samadhi, but not all their time. And that's the realm where Brahma lives, and, you know, Sakha and various other deities, okay, in that form realm. Beyond that form realm, if you are practicing even deeper samadhis, you go into what's called the formless realms. And that is so called because if you create the unwavering karma as a human being through developing one of those four realms, one of those four meditative absorptions, then you were born in one of the formless realms where you don't have a gross body and your mind is continuously in that particular meditative state. So the first of the formless realm is called infinite space. The second is infinite consciousness. Third is nothingness. And fourth is called the peak of samsara, or neither perception nor non-perception, or neither discrimination nor non-discrimination is a better translation. Okay? So you actualize those four, by, you know, having attained the four form realm absorptions and then continuing on using special meditative techniques to deepen the meditative absorption. So Alara Kamala has attained the base of nothingness, which is the third meditative absorption in the formless realm. So he's almost at the peak of samsara. The peak of samsara, that last one, is so called because it's the most sublime rebirth within samsara. Yeah. Now the problem with the formless realm absorptions is you are so, you know, you go into the absorption like that if you're reborn there. Yeah. I'm talking about taking birth in them now. If you're reborn there and you're just in that meditation for eons and eons and eons, and then when the karma finishes, the only place you have to go is down. Okay? So there's a big warning. Okay? Because first of all, at the time of the Buddha, there were many people, and we'll see Alara Kamala as one, who mistook these levels of formless meditative absorption for liberation. Because they're so peaceful, so serene, even in the jhanas, the four form realm absorptions, which are lower, where your samadhi's not quite as deep, even in those, your gross afflictions are suppressed. So let alone in the formless realm absorptions, your gross afflictions are very, very suppressed. Okay, but because they haven't developed wisdom and cut the root of samsara, they've attained the peak of samsara instead of, you know, meaning this great, you know, happiness in these meditative states. But they fall down because they still have the afflictions. The afflictions have only been temporarily suppressed, but they haven't been abandoned because it's only the wisdom realizing emptiness that abandons the afflictions completely. Okay? So that's why you find in the teachings many warnings about getting attached to the bliss of meditation, because apparently, I don't know from experience, it's so blissful that you just want to stay in those meditative states. Yeah, and you get attached, then you create that unwavering karma. But then after you experience the rebirth in the former formless realms, then you fall down and you really fall far. Okay? Yeah?
Is that way of presenting it unanimously accepted among all the different schools?
Yeah. Yeah. The Pali and Mahayana tradition presents these realms in the same way.
Yeah? Mm-hmm. It's similar to what would Rinpa fall under?
What is
Rinpa? The Dzogchen clear line.
That's a whole different thing. Okay. Yeah, yeah. That's something different, because that's not just practicing one of these deep samadhis. You're doing a whole other kind of practice, bringing your wisdom in. Okay. Okay. So Alara Kamala is saying that I've attained, you know, the base of nothingness. So the Buddha said, I considered not only Alara Kalama as faith, energy, mindfulness, concentration, and wisdom. These are called in the 37 harmonies with enlightenment, which are a Buddhist practice. These five are the five powers or the five forces. Okay, so not only does he have them, okay, I too have faith, energy, mindfulness, concentration, and wisdom. Suppose I endeavor to realize the Dharma that Alara Kalama declared he enters upon and abides in by realizing for himself with direct knowledge. So he met this teacher. It sounds good. He's saying, suppose I tried to do that myself, because just as he has, you know, faith and energy, mindfulness, concentration, and wisdom, I do too. So if I practice that path, I'll be able to actualize it. So he continues, I soon quickly entered upon and abided in that Dharma by realizing for myself with direct knowledge. Then I went to Alara Kamala and asked him, Friend Kamala, is it in this way that you declare that you enter upon and abide in this Dharma by realizing for yourself with direct knowledge? And Alara Kamala said, That is the way, friend. And the Buddha said, it is in this way, friend, that I also entered upon and abide in this Dharma by realizing for myself direct knowledge. Okay, so the Buddha's telling him he attained what the teacher taught. And then Alara Kamala says, it is a gain for us, friend. It is a great gain for us that we have such a venerable one for our companion in the holy life. So the Dharma that I declare, I enter upon and abide in by realizing for myself with direct knowledge, is the Dharma that you enter upon and abide in by realizing for yourself with direct knowledge. Okay, so saying you're my equal, I taught you the path, you actualized it. And the Dharma that you entered that you enter upon and abide in by realizing for yourself with direct knowledge is the Dharma that I declare I entered upon and abide in by realizing for myself with direct knowledge. So you know the Dharma that I know, and I know the Dharma that you know. As I am, so are you. As you are, so am I. Come, friend, let us now lead this community together. Okay, so he's saying, you've attained what I've taught, you've attained the same level, you know what I know what you know, we're equal spiritually, so let's lead this community together. So he's asking the Buddha to step in and help take over the leadership of the community. Okay? He just got a promotion. He started out as a peon in the corporation. He just got a big promotion. So in telling the story, the Buddha says, thus Alara Kalama, my teacher, placed me, his pupil, on an equal footing with himself and awarded me the highest honor. But it occurred to me, this Dharma does not lead to disenchantment, to dispassion, to cessation, to peace, to direct knowledge, to enlightenment, to nirvana, but only to reappearance in the base of nothingness. Not being satisfied with that Dharma, I left and went away. So even though he got this promotion, and he was going to be able to lead the community, which is, you know, big status, and he's going to get a lot of offerings and respect and so on and so forth, what he realized is that even though he had attained this very deep samadhi, he was still in samsara. There was no disenchantment. Okay, so there was no disenchantment with samsara. There was no dispassion. There was no giving up of craving for samsaric rebirth. There was no cessation. He still had all the defilements, even though they were temporarily suppressed. There was no direct knowledge of the nature of reality. Okay, there was no enlightenment. There was no nirvana, the total cessation of all dukkha and its causes. But there was only, the only thing he had in front of him was to be reborn again in the base of nothingness. And he saw that that was a realm that was still within samsara. And even though it's a blissful realm and you live there for eons, what's the use? You know, what's the use? So he was faced with getting the four M&Ms after 20 minutes. Yeah. Maybe even getting, you know, a whole huge bag of M&Ms after 10 minutes. But he said, what's the use? Yeah, what's the use? I get all those M&Ms. I have them, but I'm back where I started from at the end. Okay, and so it is with all the different pleasure we have in samsara. Even the pleasure of deep states of samadhi is without wisdom. You have that pleasure, you have that bliss, but at the end, you're back where you started from, and you're still caught in samsara. And when you're caught in samsara, it does, you know, of course, an upper realm is better than a lower realm, but even born in an upper realm, like that, you're going to eventually wind up in the lower realm. Because they say that we too, believe it or not, have actually had samadhi in previous lifetimes, have actualized all those deep meditative absorptions way up to the peak of samsara, have spent eons being more, you know, blissed out in samadhi, even in that highest peak of samsara meditative state. And where has it gotten us? Okay? So the Buddha had, you know, he had some real wisdom here because he looked far ahead and he saw, okay, even I could be the leader of this group, which is some worldly pleasure, that's not worth it. But even having attained this deep state of samadhi, it still hasn't fulfilled my deepest wish, and I'm still caught in samsara. So that takes a lot of courage, doesn't it? You know, when you have both worldly pleasure and meditative pleasure, to say, you know, I need to give that up, I need to continue deepening my wisdom. Okay, but that's what he did. So, not being satisfied with that dharma, then I left and went away, so the Buddha says. Okay? So he didn't leave his teacher with disgust. He didn't yell and scream and accuse him, blah, 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 blah. He just saw, I've mastered that, and now I need to go on and learn from somebody else who could teach me more. So still in search, monastics, of what is wholesome, seeking the supreme state of sublime peace, I went to Udaka Ramaputta and said to him, so Udaka Ramaputta is another leader of one of the wandering groups, and said to him, friend, I want to lead the holy life in this Dhamma and discipline. Udaka Ramaputta replied, the Venerable One may stay here. This Dharma is such that a wise person can soon enter upon and abide in it, himself realizing through direct knowledge his own teacher's instruction. So the same thing as before. I soon quickly learned that Dharma. As far as mere lip reciting and rehearsal of his teaching went, I could speak with knowledge and assurance, and I claimed I know and see, and there were others who did likewise. So here we see the exact same words, you know, occurring again. In the Pali Suttas, you see this kind of repetition in the sutras very often. Sometimes they may change a few words here and, you know, here and there, like instead of Alara Kalama, it's Udaka Ramaputta. Yeah, but the passage is the same, and that's because for the first 500 years after the Buddha lived, all the teachings were passed down orally. So there were groups of monastics that divided up the teachings and memorized them. And it was easier to memorize things if they had certain stock passages that were repeated all the time. Mm-hmm. Okay? Mm-hmm. So that's why you find this. Okay, so the Buddha continues, I considered it was not through mere faith alone that Rama declared by realizing for myself with direct knowledge, and so on and so forth, okay? So he eventually, I'll just summarize here. He then, you know, he figured, you know, Rama had some great realization because he wasn't just mouthing this, and he asked them, you know, what is it that you experience with direct knowledge? And Udaka Ramaputta said, the base of neither discrimination nor non-discrimination. So that's the peak of samsara. So he attained that one that's just above the base of nothingness that his former teacher had. And so the Buddha considered not only had Rama had faith, energy, mindfulness, concentration, and wisdom, I too have these. Suppose I endeavor to realize what Rama had realized. So he did that. He practiced as his teacher explained, and he quickly entered upon and abided in that Dhamma. Okay. And he went to Udaka Ramaputta and so it said that he had actualized that, and Udaka Ramaputra, you know, affirmed that in fact, yes, the Buddha had that particular attainment. And so then, Udaka Rama also asked him to lead his community together. Okay. So now, again, big promotion. So thus Sudaka Ramaputta, my companion in the holy life, placed me in the position of a teacher and accorded me the highest honor. But it occurred to me this Dhamma does not lead to disenchantment, to dispassion, to cessation, to peace, to direct knowledge, to enlightenment, to nirvana. Okay, so he saw there was no letting go of you know, the craving for rebirth and samsara. There was no disenchantment with it. There, it would, you know, he was still bound. His mind was still bound. And the only thing he had to look forward to was rebirth in the base of neither discrimination nor non-discrimination. So not being satisfied with that Dhamma, I left and went away. Still, so you see, you know, the Buddha left the family life, so he was giving up sensual pleasures. But he was having a hard time finding a teacher that, you know, he found one teacher that got him out of the form realm, one teacher that got him to the peak of samsara, but he couldn't yet find a teacher who led him to pure, to full enlightenment. So still in search, bhikkhus, of what is wholesome, seeking the supreme state of sublime peace, I wandered by stages through the Magadhan country until eventually I arrived at Senanigama near Uruvela. There I saw an agreeable piece of ground, a delightful grove with a clear flowing river, with pleasant smooth banks, and nearby a village for alms. I considered, this is an agreeable piece of ground. This is a delightful grove with a clear flowing river with pleasant smooth banks and nearby a village for alms. This will serve for the striving of a clansman intent on striving. And I sat down there thinking, this will serve for striving. Okay, so he found this beautiful place to meditate. He sat down. Okay, now, let's see if I can find the place. Because this sutra very quickly the next passage tells about how he attained enlightenment, but actually there's something else that comes in here that we should go through, which is in sutra number 36. Just have to find where it starts. You know, it might be actually better to start at the beginning of this other sutra. Because this part that, I'm sorry, I didn't have a chance to go through this before we came. Because what is happening now when the Buddha left his teacher? For those of you who have been to Bodh Gaya, there's a dry riverbed outside of Bodh Gaya that used to be this big, huge river. Okay, on the other side of the river, there is a place with some big, beautiful, shady trees, and that is said to be the place where the Buddha meditated for 6 years doing various extreme ascetic practices. So that's the description that comes now before the Buddha's attaining enlightenment. And I think it's good if we go through this because, you know, it's kind of showing us how the Buddha tried for himself these different directions and found what didn't work. Okay, so this, it might be actually better if I have a chance to read this beforehand. Okay, so do you have questions?
I was wondering how he fathomed something other than what was known, you know, in the world, enlightenment. How?
Like, how did he know that he wasn't fully enlightened?
No, how did you know to go after something that wasn't known?
Mm-hmm. Okay, so, yeah, how do you know to go after something that wasn't known? Well, people talked a lot about nirvana at that time. Yeah, so there was definitely that idea widespread in society. All these different wanderer groups were striving for nirvana. And the thing is, his two previous teachers thought that that's what they had attained. Okay, because they were in such deep states of samadhi. But the Buddha was intelligent enough to realize that the seeds of the affliction still remained, even though the gross afflictions had been suppressed. Okay? So he knew that he wasn't fully liberated. And with that knowledge, he said, I have to really seek full liberation. Okay? As we'll see as the story unfolds, the Buddha doesn't meet a particular teacher that teaches him this life. He figures it out by himself, but he's an extremely rare individual. And the thing is that when you read the Jataka tales of the Buddha's previous lives, it's very clear that he had many teachers and that he practiced very diligently in previous lives. Otherwise, you know, it's just what they call the wheel-turning Buddhas who start the Buddhist doctrine in an era where, in a world system where it hadn't previously existed. Just like that, only those are ones that those Buddhas in their, you know, show the aspect of attaining enlightenment without having a teacher in that lifetime. In the solitary realizer vehicle, yeah, they don't attain the full enlightenment of Buddhahood. They attain arhatship. But many of those people pray in their last life to attain it at a historical time where there is no Buddha in society. So they do in their last rebirth get born in that kind of time and attain enlightenment. But it's they're able to do it because of all the pre, but not the full enlightenment, the enlightenment of a solitary realizer. And they're able to do that because of all the practice they did in their previous lifetimes. Okay?
My impression is that the jhanas are like sequential. And it just seems like he just jumps to the all the way to the
okay. So aren't the jhanas sequential, and all of a sudden he got to the base of nothingness, and then the last one. You start out first when you're developing concentration, first you have to according to the Sanskrit tradition, go through the nine stages the nine mental abidings. Then you attain shamatha, okay? And shamatha is, at that point, you have what's called the access concentration. In other words, you don't even have the first jhana, but the five hindrances have been suppressed to a certain extent. Okay, they aren't manifest, but they haven't been fully suppressed. So it's called access or neighborhood concentration, because you're in the neighborhood and you now have the access to be able to develop the first jhana. So that's what shamatha is. But then you have to keep meditating and deepening your shamatha to get the first jhana. Okay, the first jhana comes together with five different factors. And you meditate, coarse engagement, subtle engagement, rapture, bliss, and single-pointedness. And so you meditate with those, and then you begin to let go of the coarse engagement and subtle engagement. And when you let go of those, then you attain the second jhana. Then you begin to see that rapture is nice, but it makes your mind a little bit too hyper. So you let go of that, and when you do that, you attain the third jhana. Then you see that the bliss is nice, but still bliss has a subtle element of attachment. So you get rid of that, and then you have just the one-pointedness of mind. And your feeling at that point in the fourth jhana is equanimity. In the first three, you had this rapture and bliss, but in the fourth, it's only equanimity. Okay, then what you do is whatever your meditation object was, you expand it so it fills all of space, and then you imagine withdrawing it so that you only have infinite space. Okay, and by that, then you attain the first formless realm, the base of infinite space. Then if you want to keep meditating from that, then you think that space has a consciousness that perceives it. So you remove the space and just stay with infinite consciousness. That's the second formless one. Then you think that there's infinite consciousness, yeah, but that too is, you know, kind of something positive, you know. So what happens if you take that away? Then you have the base of nothingness, yeah. And then you get even deeper in that, and you take away the nothingness, and that's the base of neither perception nor non-perception. So there's a whole way, and you've got to attain the lower ones in order to attain the higher ones. In the Bodhisattva vehicle, they master all eight of these stages, the four formless and the four form and the four formless. But the purpose of the Bodhisattva in doing that is to make their mind extremely flexible, yeah, and to develop very deep samadhi, which then they can use to meditate on bodhicitta, which they can then use to develop with the fourth jhana. You can develop psychic powers, and a bodhisattva uses those psychic powers to benefit others because they can see who they have karmic connection with. They can see somebody else's previous karma, so they know how to guide them. And the bodhisattvas develop, you know, these even higher and deeper, even formless realms. And they train their mind to go into these states of meditation and come out of them in a split second, you know, which is very difficult to do. And they're in and out of these various levels of concentration quite rapidly. So you can see, I mean, the kind of mental control that they have and mental flexibility is just totally remarkable. Yeah. But they develop all of these to develop that kind of very deep samadhi and flexibility and penetration, because then they can use it to manifest many bodies to be able to benefit sentient beings, and they can use that deep samadhi to attain full enlightenment.
Okay. Focusing on bodhicitta that prevents them from getting lost in
that? Yeah, it's the focus on bodhicitta that prevents you from getting lost in those different samadhis. Because your whole purpose of actualizing them is to be able to benefit sentient beings by attaining enlightenment. So when you have that very strong bodhicitta motivation, then that's going to prevent you from just getting taken over by the bliss you experience in those meditative states. Okay, so that's why we find that our teachers are constantly emphasizing meditation on bodhicitta much more than meditation to develop concentration. Mm-hmm. Yeah, to really implant in our mind very, very deeply the importance of bodhicitta. Yeah.
And what's the meditation object that? Or does it matter?
The meditation object, the Buddha described many different kinds of meditation objects. There's kind of 40 that's the standard list. Okay? So the four immeasurables, you know, love, compassion, joy, and equanimity fall in there. But there's also what seems to be very widespread during the time of the Buddha was what's called meditation on kasina objects. And so these are meditating on earth, water, fire, air, and there is one on space, and on blue, red, yellow, and white? Or is it green? Anyway, there's these different kasinas of colors or of the four or five elements. And so it seems like at the time of the Buddha, many people used the kasinas for their meditation object and were able to use, you know, develop their samadhi on that. In the Mahayana tradition, they're really emphasizing using the image of the Buddha to develop samadhi, because they say that it has the extra added advantages of not only developing samadhi, but also deepening your refuge and respect and feeling of closeness with the Buddha, because you're developing samadhi on the image of the Buddha. Okay? And they say that if you want to enter Tantra, that having, you know, you developing your samadhi, if you're practicing Paramita Yana first, developing it on the Buddha, then you know, sets the stage for developing it on a deity. Although in Tantrayana, some people can enter the Vajrayana without yet having full single pointedness and use the image of themselves as the deity or a subtle syllable or a subtle drop as their meditation object in Vajrayana. But the kasinas are, you know, you would, like, if I guess many people would do the earth kasina. So you would make a round form and fill it with mud and then put that up in front of you and you would look at it, you know, and then you would close your eyes and imagine it. Yeah. So the looking at it was just to gain the familiarity. And then you would close your eyes and imagine it. And you would do that until you had the image of it as vividly with your eyes closed when you were meditating as when your eyes were open. Okay? And then when you got that level of realization, then you would attain what's called the namita, which is a very subtle kind of sign or, you know, image or drop, a kind of light that appears in your meditation. And then you focus, that becomes your meditation object instead of the kasina of earth, for example. Okay. So it seems like a lot of people use that at the time of the Buddha. And I think in the Southeast Asia, some people still use the kasina objects.
What that word means?
Kasina? No, I don't know what it means. Yeah? Then some people do the four immeasurables. So like that, when I was in Thailand, the place where I stayed, that master, he didn't say so, but his disciples said, you know, that he had that realization of samadhi, using metta or love as the object. Okay? Yeah.
This is kind of an entirely different question. There's talk of the robes changing in the cultures.
Uh-huh.
Here, how does that work into it?
Okay. Okay, so talking about the robes changing in different cultures, so we talked about how it changed when it went to China. Also, in Chinese culture, having your arm exposed was considered like just not very cool. That was too risque. So they made it so that all the monastics were long sleeves. You know, even in the most incredibly hot weather, you're wearing long sleeves. When I went to Taiwan, I was like... okay, when Buddhism went to Tibet... as I heard the story, they didn't have the color dye to make the bright saffron, so they made it a deeper color and made it maroon. And you'll see some color of saffron is maroon color. The threads of the saffron are like that. And the style of the robes in many ways is the same. You know, you have what's called the five-stripe robe, which is your lower robe. They're stitched a little bit differently in the Theravada tradition and the Tibetan tradition, in the sense that the Tibetans have open flaps sometimes, although now people are stitching them down because they get caught when you're traveling and tear. And the size may be a little bit different, but the layout is pretty much the same. As far as the upper robe, that's called the seven-stripe robe, at least in the Chinese tradition, because you have seven panels, yeah, instead of five panels. And if you look at your chugus, they have seven panels, yeah. So they're in the Theravada tradition. They're again stitched a little bit differently than in our tradition. In the Chinese tradition, they're again stitched differently, and they're often brown. Yeah, and they wear the five-stripe robe as an upper robe instead of as a lower one, because they had to really change the robes very much to correspond with Chinese culture. So they actually, in China, adapted the dress of people in the Tang Dynasty. But then they had the five-stripe robe and then the seven-stripe robe. And then you have the nine-stripe robe. And when you're fully ordained, you get that. So that's nine panels. and at least 9 panels. Sometimes it has more, up to, you know, many, many panels in the Tibetan tradition, and the Chinese stay with 9, and I think the Theravadas do too. So you make, you have that robe, and that's the outer robe. In at the time of the Buddha, when you went into town, you always had to wear that outer robe. It's called the Namjar in Tibetan, and that one's double thickness, so that also served as like a sweater or a blanket too. At one of our Sangha meetings, oh, before I go into that, and the Zen tradition, when it went to Japan, when they developed their little, what do they call them, ku, I forget the Zen name, the things that they wear around the neck. If you look, those have, I think, either the 7 stripe or the 9 stripe. So the idea of it is the same, but they just made it very small because it's more practical. Okay. Lama Yeshe used to talk about changing the robes for Western culture. Yeah. And so I remember him having some people design different kinds of robes that he thought might fit in a little bit better with Western culture. So that's, you know, who knows what will happen.
We're hearing about the Buddha from the Pali Khan point of view, the Bodhisattva. And prior to that, is he a Bodhisattva in those tales as well?
Yeah, the Buddha in the Jataka tales is a Bodhisattva, but often he was, you know, he was born as a monkey or different kinds of animals also to work for the benefit of others.
Are there stories about him prior to being born?
Prior to that. There's one story about the time when he first generated bodhicitta. And I think the Buddha's name was Dipamkara at that time. I might be wrong. But his name was Sumedha, and he saw this Buddha, and he was so inspired by this Buddha that he generated the bodhicitta. Mm-hmm. And that's also recorded in the Pali scriptures. Before that, I don't know. We'll have to ask.
The 5 forces are the concentration and wisdom the same as the 6 perfections?
Yeah. Now, for example, so you're asking about the 5 forces here. There's another set that called the 5 powers. Are they the same concentration and wisdom as in the 6 perfections or 6 far-reaching practices? You'll find that many of the same qualities come repeatedly in similar circumstances that aren't exactly the same. Even within the 37 aids to enlightenment, concentration comes more than once, mindfulness comes many times, wisdom comes more than once. You know, in the far-reaching practices, you find them. But they're, while the nature is the same, you know, in these different things. I mean, wisdom is wisdom, but it's at different levels or depth of the wisdom and different ways the wisdom and concentration are used. So, for example, in the 6 perfections, wisdom and concentration are practiced with the bodhicitta motivation, so it's going to be different than if you're, let's say, a hearer or a solitary realizer practicing wisdom and concentration to attain arhatship. Also, in the practice of the 6 perfections, you meditate on what's called the circle of 3, which is that the agent, object, and action are all empty of inherent existence. Yeah, so that's another, not only motivated by bodhicitta, but sealed by this reflection on that the agent, object, and action are dependent, arising, and therefore empty themselves. Mm-hmm. So that's a special way of using, you know, developing concentration and wisdom, for example, in the practice of the 6 paramitas. Mm-hmm.
And would this energy be related to joyous effort?
Yeah, it's related to joyous effort in the Eightfold Noble Path. It's related to right effort. Okay, there's also four factors on effort that are included in the 37 harmonies to enlightenment, harmonies with enlightenment.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so it's really emphasizing to us that energy or effort is an important quality to get anywhere in your path.
Are the 37 practices in Tibetan Buddhism?
Oh, yeah, the 37 practices. The 37 harmonies with enlightenment, yes, they're definitely in Tibetan Buddhism. They're in the explanation of the Paramitayana. So, for example, you find them explained in Abhisamaya Alankara, the Ornament of Pure Realizations. Chandakirti refers to them in the supplement to the Middle Way, the Majjhimika Avatara. The idea being, in the Mahayana, in the Paramitayana, that you're meditating on the 37 harmonies with enlightenment, which sometimes are called the 37 aids to enlightenment, the 37 wings to enlightenment. There's many different translations. You meditate on those with the bodhicitta motivation and with seeing them all as empty of inherent existence.
Another question was, I was a little confused. So in the Pali tradition, they see the Buddha as a bodhisattva.
Mm-hmm.
And in his lifetime of 600 BC, whatever, do they say he was born as a bodhisattva or he was born as an ordinary?
Okay. So, so in the Pali tradition, the Buddha in that last lifetime, when he was born, you know, on our planet, he was born as a bodhisattva, but he wasn't yet an Arya bodhisattva. He was on the path of preparation. Except, of course, they didn't have those titles like mm-hmm. Path of Preparation at the time. Those mm-hmm. kind of titles came later. But, you know, so he had some realization. He had the bodhicitta, some understanding, mm-hmm. you know, of wisdom. But he hadn't perfected it yet. The novices in the Tibetan tradition do have a five-star road. That's your shamdha.
It doesn't have a five-star.
That's because you're not fully ordained.
So
oh, I'm sorry. Yeah, you're right. The novices don't have the five-stripe. The bhikshus and bhikshunis have the five-stripe.
So it was my impression that the novices were supposed to have the seven and the five. Of course, this is the equivalent mm-hmm. of the five. So.
Yeah, the Shamdap is kind of like the equivalent of the five. You have the Chogu, which is the seven stripe. By the way, these terms, five, seven, and nine stripe, that is Chinese terms. The Tibetans don't call them with those. They just say Shamdap and Chogu and Namjar. Yeah, but the number of panels are the same. But so when you are a novice, then you get the Chogu. But you can't wear the shenda because you're not a full monastic yet.
Okay, so would that have been that way in the Buddhist time?
Well, you know, at the very beginning, they were just wearing any kind of rags they can get. And at the very beginning, they didn't have this difference between novice and fully ordained. Okay? At the very beginning, somebody came and said to the Buddha, I want to be your monastic follower. And the ordination ceremony was Kamo Bhikkhu. That was it. You know. And for the first 12 years, there weren't even any precepts to keep. Yeah. And then the novice ordination came about because there were some young children who had ordained, and the full ordination was very difficult for them. And so they were crying and, you know, and so on and so forth. And so the Buddha heard of this. And so then he said, okay, well, we'll have a novice ordination. They won't take as many precepts. And, you know, you have to be at least old enough to, what was it? Something
scare
to
away the crows.
Yeah, to scare away the crows. In order, so about 8 years old. You know, to be able to take the novice ordination. Okay. And then you have to be 20 in order to take the full ordination. Okay. So let's sit quietly a few minutes. And then let's dedicate. Due to this comparison, I attain the enlightened state of Guru Buddha, that we may be able to liberate all sentient beings from their suffering. May the precious word divine not yet born arise and grow. May that born of no divine, but in peace forever.